Shalom, welcome to Ask JTF, the program in which we attempt to answer questions from our great JTFers. I'm Chaim Ben Pesach from the Jewish Task Force. Before we begin the program, this program is dedicated to Erefuah Shlema, complete recovery for Sharon Mitman, Shlomo Ben Sara, and Dorit Bat Sara, and to Ilui Neshamot, elevating of the souls for Malka Bat Meir, Allegra Bat Shlomo, Daniel Nankin, Victor Chazdai, Pesach Zev Ben Dov, Lunita Adler, Shifra Hoffman, Ruven Hoffman, Barry Hoffman, Harab Mir Kahana, Harab Binyamin Kahana, Tzipora Fegi Bat Liba, Yosef Ben Meir, Robert Mitman, Dennis Shore, Helen Friedman, and Charles Zolot. I want to speak about what might be described as a philosophical question this week. And this is an experiment. I don't know if people enjoy are doing these types of programs on Jewish philosophical issues, but we're going to try it on Jewish, what is Jewish thinking and Jewish philosophical thinking on issues involving the creation, involving God, involving the world. Do you like programs like that, or do you want me to only to stick to current events in the news? We'll see what the responses are to this program in order to see whether people actually like this type of program. But this week I want to try discussing our understanding of God. We can't understand God. No one understands God. That's why various religions, the Christians try to make God into a human being who died on a cross, and other various religions that engage in idolatry try to humanize God or limit God. But of course, God has no limitations. God is absolutely all-powerful and unlimited and completely, there's a oneness of God that's absolute perfection, because if you have perfection, then there's an absolute oneness. There has to be. And yet, understanding that, we still cannot really understand the nature of God, because God is infinite and we're finite. God is endless, and we have great limitations, and God has no limitations. So we can't possibly begin to comprehend a concept of no limitations when we have limitations. Impossible for us to fully comprehend that. In fact, let's go a little further on the program, because we've discussed this in the past, what I just mentioned now. But we're going to go a little further on the program this week, and we're going to discuss the Jewish views of subjective and objective thinking and subjective and objective ways of looking at the world. Subjective means that you look at something in the world as to how it relates to you, your relationship to something. In other words, if I have here a cell phone, my subjective relationship to the cell phone, my subjective view of the cell phone is how it affects my life, how I relate to it. That's subjectively looking at the cell phone. And everybody can have a different view. Other people have different views of cell phones or of anything else in the world. That's subjective thinking. Objective thinking is that I look at the object and I try to understand the cell phone itself. Not how it relates to me, but the cell phone itself, the object itself, I want to understand. And of course, I can't understand the cell phone. Because although I may know how it is made from certain, I can learn, I don't know how it's made, I'm not an expert on creating cell phones, but of course I can learn what materials were put into making it, how it was put together in a material and physical sense. I can do that. But I still won't understand the cell phone itself, because we don't understand anything in the physical world. We understand nothing. We don't understand what molecules are. We don't understand what atoms are. We don't understand, I'm looking at a computer now, we don't understand really what the essence of a computer or of a table or of a chair or of wood or of a living creature. We don't understand really what the essence is. We don't even understand our own essence. When I say essence, in other words, we don't understand what really makes us tick and what really creates us and what really keeps us going and what really keeps the world going. We have no idea. We can describe in a practical sense certain aspects of molecules and atoms and tables and chairs and lights and houses and people. But we don't understand their real essence because we are too limited to even understand that. Not only don't we understand God, who is unlimited, we don't understand even things that are limited. Not really. In the deepest sense of the word, we don't understand these things. And I hope this isn't too deep for people to think about. We don't really understand. We only understand, for instance, a chair in a subjective sense. Subjective means, again, how it affects us, that we sit on the chair, how it affects us in our relationship to the chair, or our relationship to a computer, our relationship to a television set, or our relationship to another human being, or another living creature. But we don't understand the essence of what really makes that other. We don't understand the essence, for instance, of the billions of cells that work in the human body. We don't understand those things. We don't understand how somebody can see, how when somebody is alive, they can see, and then a moment after they pass away, they can't see anymore, even though the same eye, the same physical eye still is there, but it just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't exist anymore. We don't really understand how that works. We don't understand how our body digests food, and Hashem created a world in which our body divides. I mean, it's so complex and so magnificent and so beautiful when you think about it. Hashem created a world where our body naturally divides up the food and sends it to different areas in accordance with the needs of our body. You need vitamins, it's sent here. You need minerals, it's sent there. If it's something unhealthy, but the body is digesting it because you ate something unhealthy, then it's going to clog the arteries. But things are going to be sent to different parts of the body and divided up by our body. Incredible. Our body is more sophisticated than the most sophisticated laboratory. Just like a little bird is more sophisticated than the most advanced planes. But we don't understand really how that bird flies, or really how that bird functions, or really how that bird is created, or how a human being is created. We don't understand those things. We don't have the deepest sense of knowledge of how these things really function. Our knowledge is so limited and so minimal. And I'm talking about the greatest scientists and the greatest experts. The greatest scientists and the greatest experts and the greatest geniuses in history cannot create something from nothing. Yes, they can recreate life. They can create life from things that are already living. But they can't create life from things that aren't alive and that aren't living. They can't create life. They can't create something from nothing. We have no idea how that happens. We have no idea how a tiny sperm cell, a microscopic tiny sperm cell, develops into a human being and grows eyes that can see, that are the most incredible, perfect camera in real time, can see things and digest and digest mentally what they're seeing in real time. The most advanced human camera can't do that, what our eyes can do, the functions that our eyes can perform. How does that little sperm cell create eyes that can do that? How does that little sperm cell create a digestive system that can break apart food into different chemicals in different parts of the body and separate it brilliantly, magnificently, and turn it into things that help us function as human beings? How does that little sperm cell turn into a human being who thinks and loves and hates and creates and has the ability to understand and believe in God, understand that he's a creature and that there's a creator? How does that little sperm cell turn into a human being with those powers and that ability? We don't understand those things. And the most brilliant, ingenious scientists in their art, and human beings are brilliant. Human beings are incredibly brilliant. Brilliant. Look at the world. Look at all the advances in technology and medicine and everything. Brilliant. And yet, with all their brilliance, they don't understand the most basic functions of human life in terms of the real objective essence of a molecule, of an atom, of an object, of the air we breathe, of the physical things we see. They don't understand those things. The brilliant people used to say to religious people, the Greek philosophers and the brilliant people used to say, if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. I don't believe anything I can't see. If I can't see it, it doesn't exist. I don't believe it. And that was considered to be common sense and considered to be wisdom. That's what passed for wisdom for centuries, for thousands of years. People who didn't want to accept God's dominion in the world, that was accepted as wisdom. But now we know that even in the physical sense, forget about spiritual sense, that's a whole different world, even far and beyond. But even in the physical sense, what you see is not what really is there. You're not seeing what's really there. You think you have open spaces here, but there are billions and trillions of cells and molecules and atoms. And in the atmosphere, you have billions and trillions of molecules and atoms. And so this is not just open space here, what you think is open space, because you don't see the atoms and you don't see the molecules. But it's there. And if I look at a piece of paper here, or if I look at, let's take my cell phone again, I look at my cell phone, I think this is it. This is not it. I think that this is doesn't move, doesn't have any life to it, but it has life to it. If you looked under a microscope, there are molecules and atoms and action taking place in this dead cell phone, this supposedly dead cell phone. And the same is true for this pen, and the same is true for everything we look at. What you see is not what is really there. There's something beyond and far deeper, even in the physical sense, than what we're able just to see. Let alone in the spiritual sense. Let alone the fact that when the soul has departed from the body, it is the soul that is controlling us. It is the soul that gives us life, not our bodies. Our physical bodies are like clothes that we wear. It's like clothes, physical body. That's all it is. Because a dead person still has eyes, but he can't see. Because his soul has departed from his body. He still has a nose, he can't breathe. He still has ears, but he can't hear. He still has a brain, but he can't think anymore. 1 minute before his death, his ears and his eyes and his brain were all functioning. Now the same exact brain and the same exact eyes and the same exact ears that didn't change in 1 minute. Once the soul departs from the body, they don't function anymore as a living human being. So it's the soul that's deciding. It's not the fact that we have eyes that we see. The eyes are controlled by something else within us that we don't understand, and that the greatest scientists don't understand. Our brains are controlled by... Our brain is not just what you see, the picture of brain. You see the pictures and diagrams of a brain. Our brain, there's something else there beyond the physical manifestation that enables that brain to dream and imagine. And that's the godly part of us, because in the physical world we're limited, but our dreams are unlimited, are limitless, which is why we can never find true happiness in this world in the fullest sense of the word. Not in this world, not baolam hazeh, in this world we can never find true complete happiness, because man, the godly part of man, aspires to unlimited happiness and enjoyment and pleasures and achievements and accomplishments. And you can't do that. If you enjoy eating, there's a limit to how much you can eat. If you enjoy whatever you enjoy drinking, there's a limit to how much you can drink. If you enjoy other physical things in life, there's a limit to how much you can do them. But our imagination has no limit. If you're a billionaire and you're worth $200 billion like the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, maybe worth $200 billion, incredible amount of money. And yet there's a limit on his wealth, and there's a limit on what he could do. Even he has limitations. But our minds are unlimited. Our desires are unlimited. We dream of the day when we could have unlimited accomplishment and achievement. And when it won't all come to an end when we die and pass away. When we could have eternal life. So, the world that we see, not only is it impossible for us to understand Hashem, to understand God, it's impossible even for us to understand the essence, the true objective essence of objects in this world, let alone human beings, even just simple objects in this world, we don't really understand. We don't really understand the atoms and the molecules that make this thing go. We don't really understand it. Not in the deepest sense. Even the people who created this cell phone, they created it with their limited knowledge of the materials needed to put this cell phone together. But they don't understand the deep essence and object and of the objects themselves that were used even to create this cell phone. They don't. They learned how to put cell phones together through trial and error. They learned how to do it through endless experimentation and were amazed when it worked. When it finally worked. That's how people discover things. Discoveries are made that are amazing. But we don't, it's not that we figured it out because we really understand the essence of how everything works. Because, again, we don't. But we do know certain things. We know that, for instance, if we're logical, we would know that a God who's perfect and all-powerful has to be good. That God needs nothing if he's perfect and all-powerful. He didn't create the world because he's lonely or because he wanted company or any other silly reason. He created the world because he doesn't need anything. He has everything. He created the world because even though we don't understand it to the fullest and in the deepest sense we don't understand it, but God is altruistic, is an idealist. God wants to share the greatest good with us, and the greatest good is God himself. He wants us to have knowledge of his existence and his presence and of all the good, and he wants us to emulate all of his good characteristics and traits, just as he's kind and compassionate and filled with love and concern and desire for truth and justice and righteousness. We should have those traits as much as possible. We're human beings. We have a Yetzer Hara, an evil inclination, Yetzer HaTov, a good inclination. But despite that, we should try to use our Yetzer Hara and HaYetzer HaTov to emulate God's characteristics as much as possible. Even the Yetzer Hara, even the evil inclination, which is the selfish inclination, Yetzer HaTov is the selfless inclination, the desire to help others and give to others and sacrifice and do for others. The evil inclination is the desire only for yourself, everything is yourself, whether it's egotistical or whether it's material or whatever the reason, or just personal pleasures. That's the evil inclination. But even the evil inclination can be used for good. What if, for instance, you eat meals, not just because you enjoy the food, but because you want to live so that you can do better for this world and make this a better world and help others? That's why you eat. That's why you wake up in the morning. That's why you earn money. That's why you learn professions. That's why you put together a business, because you want to be able to contribute to good causes and fight for good things and stand up for justice and make things better for your family, your loved ones, your community, and your people, the Jewish people. And if you're righteous Gentile, also for the Jewish people. Anyway, this was just a little digression from our usual discussions every week into a little philosophy about life. And I don't know if people enjoyed it or didn't enjoy it or like when I do these types of shows. But from time to time, maybe we'll do it. We'll see what the reaction is from from our great JTFers and from people who see the program. In the meantime, there is something good you could do that God definitely wants you to do. And we know that from his prophets, from the Nevi'im in the Tanakh, from his prophets in the Bible. He wants the land of Israel to be given to the Jewish people. He wants us to have from the Nile to the Euphrates. He doesn't want us giving up our biblical heartland to create a so-called Palestinian state in Israel's biblical heartland and push Israel to borders that are 6 to 9 miles wide, suicidal borders. He definitely doesn't want that. That would be a terrible sin, a terrible crime. And you know, those of you who watch this program, you know the only people that are really and truly fighting the battle and really putting themselves on the line on this issue are the Hilltop Youth. Noar HaGevaot in Hebrew. They're the ones who are fighting the good battle. And so, if you want to do something useful with your life, support your family, love your family, love the people around you, but also care about the future of the world and especially the struggle for the land of Israel, which is the premier struggle of our time, the land of Israel and the Jewish people in their land. That's the premier struggle. Read the Bible. That's where all the action is in the Bible. And Bible is God's blueprint. God gave us a blueprint. God didn't just give us a refrigerator or a stereo set or a computer. Just hand over a computer without giving us directions or instructions on what to do. God gave us a blueprint. He gave us the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. That's Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. And he gave us the Tanakh, the Bible, the whole Bible. And he gave us Torah Shebe'al Peh. He gave us the oral Torah. So God has given us instructions and given us a blueprint on how to do things, and we know that that blueprint is the true blueprint because we see the Jewish people, this tiny little people, is the number one influence on the world in every generation, the incredible, way out of proportion to any logical numbers, the power and influence of the Jews. We know, therefore, that book is true from the history of the Jewish people. We know that that's the true way of God, that he kept his word thousands of years ago when he said he would choose the Jewish people and have a sacred covenant with them, and it would be Brit Olam, an eternal covenant with them. He kept his word and he brought them back to the land of Israel 20 centuries later. He didn't bring them back to let Arab Muslim terrorists take over the heartland of biblical Israel, God forbid, chas v'chalila. What a crime that would be. What a tragedy and what disaster that would be for the world. And it can happen. It can happen unless we act. Unless we help the Hilltop Youth. And JTF is the only organization outside of Israel that's raising money to help the Hilltop Youth. Here's how you can help the Hilltop Youth and do what you should be doing to make this a better world. There are two ways to help the Hilltop Youth. One is on PayPal. You go to hayamin.org, which is our Hebrew main page. And on hayamin.org, our Hebrew main page, there's a donate button in English. Most of the page is in Hebrew, but there's a donate button in English on top. And you click on the donate button, and in several minutes, you can very easily and conveniently donate to help the Hilltop Youth. 100% of our budget is to promote the Hilltop Youth and help the Hilltop Youth and to help the cause of the land of Israel and the Jewish people. So that's online, if you want to help online. If you want to help through sending it through the regular mail, you can do that with checks and money orders that you make out to JTF. You make the check or money order out to JTF and you send it to JTF, P.O. Box 650327. Fresh Meadows, New York, 11365. That's JTF, P.O. Box 650327, Fresh Meadows, New York, 11365. Let's help the Hilltop Youth save the land of Israel. And what a blessing that will be for us on Yom HaDin, on the Day of Judgment, if we played a crucial role in helping the Hilltop Youth save the land of Israel. You have no idea. You have no idea how much good that will do for you and for your family and your loved ones on Yom HaDin, on the Day of Judgment, if you do good. We have to do good in this world. And that is certainly the best cause I can think of in our generation. Okay, let's get to our questions from our great JTFers. And we start out this week with our friend Yimach Shmoda Islam, who writes, and I quote, thoughts on these black celebrities. Okay, and the four black celebrities, one is MC Hammer, who is a rapper, who, and Kevin Durant. Is a basketball player, isn't he? I think he's a basketball player, if I'm not mistaken. People, these two guys, you know, very successful, made money. What do they do with it? MC Hammer sings songs that are full of immorality and decadence. Kevin Durant makes a lot of money. He's part of the black community and part of a community that really, unfortunately, has a culture that's very evil. So they're not living the lives that people are supposed to live. And then the third person on the list is Mike Tyson, Yimach Shmoda Zichro, this filthy, stinking beast who spent 7 years in prison for raping a woman and who's just a beast. I mean, he's a beast. He likes Louis Farrakhan, the black Hitler. He hates whites and Jews. He hates everybody. He calls himself a Muslim. And, like, you know, black Muslim, and he rapes women and attacks people and uses... He's a boxer and uses his boxing skills to hurt people and attack people, and like women, to attack women and force himself upon women. And he's highly respected in the black community. And the fourth person on the list is Drake. Drake, you know, he has a black father and a Jewish mother. So Drake, under Jewish law, al pi halacha, according to Jewish law, is actually a Jew. And he's made hundreds of millions of dollars with his music, which, you know, which really should be called, his name is Drake, his name should really be Drek. Because that's what his music is. Music is dreck. It's for people with an IQ in the single digits, morons, who have no morality and no decency and are just human garbage, human trash. And he made hundreds of millions of dollars. Do you know that he bought a home in Canada for $100 million and then later bought homes for $70 million, $50 million? This guy has hundreds of millions of dollars he's making. Hundreds of millions of dollars. And he's Jewish. His mother is Jewish, and she had relations with a black anti-Semite. And he has videos with hundreds of millions of views. Hundreds of millions of views listening to his... That I can't even listen to it for 10 seconds. I couldn't listen to one of his so-called songs. For 10 seconds, I couldn't listen to that dreck. And he has hundreds of millions of views? What type of world do we live in? Look at how upside down the world is. These are the things that we have to change. Look at the difference between this human excrement and the great heroes of the hilltop youth. Look at the great difference. Thank you, Yimach Shmoda Islam. And now we go to our other friend, Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, can you please discuss your views on the recent mass shootings here in the United States? More exactly, the shootings in Buffalo, New York, and in Texas. Also, do you think there should be a ban on guns? Thanks. Unquote. Well, the shootings are evidence of the fact that the people I was just discussing, the people with rap music and the people, all the, you know, just the influence over young people today is all negative and decadent and evil and immoral, and this is what it leads to. These are the consequences of having a society that's immoral and evil. Having a society with no moral compass, this is what happens. Should there be a ban on guns? God forbid. God forbid. Chas v'chalila, God forbid. Every Jew should own guns. Legally, of course. Legally. Every Jew should have legal firearms. If the Jews had been armed before the Holocaust, millions of Jewish lives could have been saved. When the Germans first attacked the Warsaw Ghetto, there were only 30,000 Jews left. Most of them were starving to death, were starving just in terrible shape. And these 30,000 Jews with homemade weapons held back the German army longer than the nation of France. France, which had a bigger standing army than Nazi Germany, surrendered faster than the Jews of the Warsaw Ghetto. The Jews of the Warsaw Ghetto never surrendered. They fought to the end. The Jews of the Warsaw Ghetto lasted longer than all of Poland. And the German commanders wrote back to Hitler, you machmo, when they first, the first day when they decided, they thought they're going to march in and just kill all these Jews, because they figured the Jews would be easy to kill, because most of the Jews in the Holocaust didn't fight back and didn't resist and were easy to kill. But on the first day, all of a sudden, a lot of German soldiers were killed. They saw the Jews fighting back ferociously with homemade weapons. And they wrote back to Hitler saying, you know, a gun in the hand of a Jew makes the Jew very dangerous. A Jew can be very dangerous when there's a gun in his hand. The combination of Jews with guns and Jewish brains can be very lethal. And if instead of 30,000 Jews who were already half starved to death in the Warsaw Ghetto resisting the whole German army, if instead millions of Jews in Europe had fought back and had been armed, the results would have been very different during the Holocaust. Rabbi Kahana, of blessed memory, our great leader, Harav Meir David Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik V'Kadosh Livracha, Hashem Yikom Damo, he used to say, every Jew a 22, and he didn't mean literally a 22. He actually preferred firearms that are better than that. But he said every Jew a 22 because it rhymes. But he wanted Jews to be armed. And Jabotinsky, who warned them that the Holocaust was coming, warned the Jews of Europe to be armed. And they would, oh, how silly, it's ridiculous, you don't need it, what's wrong with you? What, you don't understand that this is not, that's not the Jewish way? If they had listened to Jabotinsky, and if they had listened to Jews like Rabbi Kahana, what a different world we'd live in. And by the way, if the children in that school in Texas, for instance, if their teachers had been armed and trained in firearms, and if there had been an armed guard in every school, if there was an armed guard in the school, the probability is this never would have taken place. Thank you, Joe Gutfeld. And we go now to our other friend, Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, where were you flying in last week's affirmative action story from JFK Airport? Binyamin, I prefer not to say, because it was, my mother and I used to go, we used to fly at least twice a year. My late mother, Malka Bat Meir, Zichrona Livracha Leah HaShalom, may her memory live on, and may peace be upon her. But I prefer not to say we were flying. I have a reason why I don't want to specify where we were flying. And then Binyamin writes, you previously said you didn't have an affirmative action story for LaGuardia Airport, but last week you said you did. Can you share one from LaGuardia Airport? Were you traveling to, where were you traveling to, and was it before or after the September 11th attacks? Unquote. Well, again, sometimes when we left New York City, we would fly out of New York City. So sometimes we'd get a flight, we'd book a flight, and sometimes it left LaGuardia and sometimes it left JFK. Both airports, by the way, are terrible. But LaGuardia is even worse. But every time we left JFK or LaGuardia, we had to encounter the TSA, who are the people that check you when you're going in for security, and just other people in the airport. And they were affirmative action stories because they were often very oppressive and cruel toward my mother, who was almost 88 years old. Nasty, cruel, disgusting people. And so, you know, that's why there were stories also from LaGuardia, because it depended. You know, when I booked a flight to leave New York with myself and my mother, sometimes they left out of LaGuardia and sometimes out of JFK. So, of course, there was encounters with affirmative action people in both airports. Binyamin now writes, two, if you put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig. Why does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wear lipstick? Unquote. I agree with you. I agree with you. She is a pig. She'll always be a pig. She's a Nazi pig. And I apologize to the four-legged pigs, because the four-legged pigs are God's creatures. They didn't do anything wrong. They're not kosher. The goyim can eat them. The goyim are allowed to eat the four-legged pigs, but we're not allowed to eat them. They're not kosher, but they're still God's creatures. There's nothing wrong with a pig. But the two-legged pigs, like her, There's a lot wrong with them. Thank you, Binyamin. And now we go to Ram Sheva Sheva Efes, whose question is going to be in Hebrew. And I'm glad to see that it's not a long question this week, which is always good, which is always helpful, because most of our JTFers, our great JTFers, don't understand Hebrew. So I'm going to read it quickly and translate it quickly. Ram writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim HaTzadik, Ma Shalomcha. Ani sameach sheosim sichat zoom b'shnemasar lachodesh ani ishit ve'anashim sheli nismach sheze yiyeh b'sha'a 8:30 ba'erev ki yesh anashim lifnei ze b'mincha ve'arvit. Toda rabah. She'ata mityaches elai yafe. Ohev otcha meod be'ahavat Yisrael Ram Meir Avraham. And he writes that we're going to have a Zoom conference on June 12th in Hebrew with the Israelis. On June 12th, we're going to be having a Zoom conference. We've done it before. We're going to have another one here. And he writes that they'd like to do it at 8:30 because they have mincha. They have to pray mincha and arvit. And so, to give them time to conclude the prayers, let me just answer him quickly. Ram, ein li baya lasot et ze 8:30, im ze ma sheta ve'kol hatzadikim b'Yisrael ma'adifim, ein li baya im ze, im ata rotze 8:30, ze beseder. Kol od she'teadken oti, aval akshav ani maniach she'ze yeh 8:30. Okay, and now we're going to our good friend Hirvatsky Noachide, who always asks great questions. Hirvatsky writes, and I quote, why does the Torah tradition discourage punishment by incarceration, unquote? Great question, and the reason is because the Torah, if we're interested in rehabilitation, it depends what you're interested in. Incarceration is for punishment. It's not for rehabilitation. You don't rehabilitate people through incarceration. You rehabilitate people through other means. Incarceration is supposed to be a deterrent. It's supposed to be a punishment. And the Torah emphasizes how you rehabilitate somebody who's done something wrong. That doesn't mean that the Torah would oppose imposing punishments that are necessary for society. The Torah would not oppose it. In our day, for instance, the Torah, as we all know, permits the death penalty even for offenses that are harmful to society. So punishments are permitted. Incarceration was not considered to be a particularly practical method thousands of years ago, when we had the oral and written Torah at that time. You know, that wasn't considered to be a practical approach at that time. But in our day and age, we may not have a choice. We probably don't have a choice. There are people that have to be incarcerated. Let's remember that there are two types of punishment. There's punishment according to Beit Din, according to a rabbinic court. And then there's punishment according to the laws of the melech, of the king. Each of them are allowed to impose different types of punishment. The melech is not bound by the punishments that we see in the Torah. The melech, the king, can impose his own punishments if it's necessary for the orderly running of society. For Jews in a Jewish state, which is what the Torah focused on to a great degree, for Jews in the Jewish state, there was the concept of avdut. Instead of incarceration. Avdut means slavery. Literally means slavery or indentured servitude. It's not slavery like we think of slavery, because the slavery that we think of was very cruel. Actually, this type of so-called slavery, this type of servitude, was very humane. And the slaves were treated as well as members of the family. But they were required to serve up to 6 years in order to pay off their debt to society if they had done something wrong, if for stealing and doing various other things. They would have to work for a family and would have to serve that family and would in effect be servants there and not earn any money during that 6 years and just have to serve the family. And that was considered preferable to incarceration if you're interested in rehabilitation, if that's your main objective. But if you're interested in just taking people off the street, first of all, to protect society, you're allowed to do whatever you have to do to protect people. That you're allowed to do. You're allowed to protect people. That's number one. And you're allowed to have law and order and protection for people. And the reason I'm saying that Torah mainly dealt with punishments involving Jews is because the Torah gave a lot of flexibility to the Gentiles. Because in the next world, of course, in the world to come, the Gentiles are going to be running the countries outside of Israel. B'nai Noach, the followers of Noah, they're going to be the leaders and the people running all the countries outside of Israel. The Jews are going to be living in the land of Israel. All the other nations outside are going to be run by the Gentiles. And so the Gentiles, they're going to have a lot of flexibility on how to deal with this. Of course, they have to have laws with. They have to have justice and they have to have righteousness and there have to be certain parameters. But there's a lot of flexibility given there because different Gentile societies might have different requirements. Anyway, I hope that that's at least somewhat of an enlightening answer. Thank you, Hirvatsky. And now we go to our friend Zera Yisrael Kahanist, or in English, Zera Israel Kahanist, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim. 1. Please comment on the following. Joseph Tomasi, Yimach Shmo, James Mason, may he be wiped off the earth, and the cronies of the Adam Waffen Division. Okay. Joseph Tomasi was a Nazi who, Baruch Hashem, was shot to death when he was 25 years old by another Nazi. And James Mason was one of his followers. And, of course, they're just sick subhuman scum, no other way to describe, just pure evil. And the group you're referring to, Adam Waffen Division, they're trying to say that they're like the Waffen SS during the Holocaust. Vermin, pure vermin. And now Zedar writes, and I quote, 2. Wikipedia calls Kahanism a brand of neo-fascism. Would you consider it fascist? Unquote. Of course not. Wikipedia is fascist. The Wikipedia censors are fascists. They're fascists. And all the social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Google, Twitter isn't in the hands of Elon Musk. I hope Elon Musk will change it. I'm skeptical, but I hope he will change it. But right now, Twitter is also fascist. They're all fascists. They all censor good people and righteous people and moral people and let all the evil people continue to write whatever they want and do whatever they want. They're true fascists. And Wikipedia is very, very evil and very anti-Semitic and very fascistic. And it's a site full of lies. What they print are lies. They only let liars and fascists and anti-Semites write on the site. They don't let good people correct anything there. Thank you, Zera. And now we go to our great friend Nachas, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim. 1. What is your take on Golem and Nephilim? The Golem is a creature that was created supposedly in Prague, to a giant, powerful creature that was created to fight off enemies of the Jewish people when we had pogroms and we had danger to the Jewish people. But it's not, it's a symbolic story, of course. And the reason that rabbinic scholar, Talmidei Chachamim, rabbinic scholars created it is because belief in the Torah and leaning upon the true Torah giants of our generation, that's what leads us. The moral of the story is that following them is what will create the deterrent and the defense against our being attacked and our facing destruction. That's the moral of the story behind the story of the Golem. The other story is Nephilim. Nephilim are creatures that they're not really creatures. They were human beings, but they're called Nephilim in the Bible. And some people translate it, they're just very large creatures, very large people, actually. And some even refer to them as giants. Some translate as giants, even though Nephilim is not the word for giants in Hebrew. But again, symbolic story of how you can be enormous and powerful and supposedly have great power and great strength. And in the end, it's not going to help you if you don't believe in God, if you don't follow the ways of God. Think about it. The most powerful man doesn't have the strength of a horse or an elephant. Elephants and horses are stronger than the most powerful human beings. So, and I believe, by the way, in working out, and I believe that people should be muscular and should build up their muscles and should work out, first of all, because it's healthy, and also because people should learn how to defend themselves and how to fight. I believe in all of that. We believe very strongly in all of that. But let's not kid ourselves. That's important. But in the end, we're still dependent on God. We still have to do what God commands us to do with our own strength and our own physical strength. That's not going to be good enough to cut it. And that's really what this, that's a symbolic take on what the story of Nephilim is all about. That you can be a giant and you can be very powerful, but in the end, it's not gonna, you're still going to disappear if you don't follow the ways of God. And then Nachas writes, and I quote, Do you also believe that eventually a righteous Jewish billionaire will finally see the light and realize that JTF and the Blessed Hilltop Youth are the only Jewish causes worthy of support? Unquote. Bezrat Hashem, God willing, I hope so. I hope so, Nachas. Nachas, this will be such a better world. Such a better world if we could get real support for the for this magnificent cause. It will impact way beyond Judea and Samaria. It will set an example for the whole world. It will be way beyond. Just as the Jews are supposed to be a light unto the nations, the hilltop youth, they are a light unto the nations. They're what we're supposed to be. And so if we had true support for them, if we could really give them true support, it would literally change the world. I believe that. I believe that it would make this a better world. Nachas now writes, please discuss the following individuals. William F. Buckley, he was a horrible, evil, phony, hypocrite, a pseudo-conservative, not a real conservative, an establishment fraud who worked with the establishment his whole life and supported the establishment, and was an anti-Semite, by the way. How do I know he was an anti-Semite? Because he claims to be very right-wing on American issues and all these other issues. But on Israel, that's the one place where he's left-wing, where he told Israel to give up the land. He told Israel to give away all the land and surrender in Judea and Samaria and the Golan. And he told Israel to surrender everything, Jerusalem. He was in favor, he was against America giving up anything. He claimed to be. But when it comes to Israel, all of a sudden he becomes a left-winger. That's a true anti-Semite. Someone who's right-wing for everything, but for the Jews, left-wing, left for the Jews, he wants them to surrender. That's a real anti-Semite. And obviously he's left-wing for the Jews because he wants to hurt the Jews. He wants the Jews to commit suicide. And that's what Buckley was, an anti-Semite. And Professor Walter E. Williams. Walter Williams was an establishment black guy who started out as a typical black who hated whites and, you know, was supported Malcolm X and hated whites, but then eventually became a conservative and eventually became friendly with Rush Limbaugh. I don't think he's a particularly bad guy, but I don't think he was. Did he really do something constructive for the world, him and Rush Limbaugh and these other pseudo conservatives? What did they, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not impressed with the establishment conservatives, and he was an establishment conservative. Cal Thomas is the next one that Nachas writes about. Cal Thomas is an evangelical Christian. I enjoyed reading some of his articles on Israel. I enjoyed reading. He actually once wrote a column. He used to write a column. And he was started out as a reporter, actually, for NBC News, and then eventually became a columnist. He was an evangelical Christian who was a very strong supporter of Israel. And he once wrote a column explaining why the Jews should throw the Arabs out of Israel. I loved it. I love something no Jewish columnist would ever write. But this evangelical Christian Gentile wrote that. So I liked him in that respect. If he's part of the Christian, unfortunately, though, the evangelical Christians have disappointed me lately because they slavishly follow whatever the Israeli government tells them to do, and they will not go against what the Israeli government wants. And, you know, Until I see evangelical Christians giving millions of dollars to the Hilltop Youth and to the real Jews that are fighting for the land of Israel, I'm not impressed with their support for Israel. And Nachas now writes, and I quote, Neil Diamond. Neil Diamond is an intermarried, self-hating Jew, a whore, who wrote Xmas songs, who never used his power and influence. He was very successful in the music business and in the entertainment industry. Never used his tremendous power, influence, and money to help Jews. Never. All he did is intermarry, write Xmas songs. He's a self-hating Jewish whore. And Bob Hope. Bob Hope, you know, Bob Hope, when Ben Hecht and Peter Berkson were trying to save the Jews during the Holocaust, Bob Hope agreed to help them. Bob Hope, who's a Gentile from Ohio, he agreed to help them right away. He was willing to help. Ben Hecht could always count on Bob Hope to try to help. Unlike most of the Jews in Hollywood. Most of the Jews in Hollywood were, you know, self-hating vermin. But Bob Hope was willing to help. So I like Bob Hope for that reason. Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart, I don't know that much about him other than I know that he was a great actor. He was a very great... He seems to be a decent guy. Seemed to be a decent guy, and he was certainly a great actor. And Henry Winkler. Thanks. Okay. Henry the Winkler. I don't know if people even know who he is. Young people know who he is. The Fonz from Happy Days in the 70s, a show in the 70s. A show which I never watched once, but I know about it from articles and newspapers and things, you know. Even though I never liked television. I never watched any of those types of shows. But Henry Winkler, he did marry another Jew, which is rare for Hollywood. He married a Jew. But he does shows and he has businesses in Germany. And I don't know of anything of value that he's ever done for Jews, even though, again, he's wealthy and powerful and famous and could do great things for Jews, and he could solve our problem with the Hilltop Youth. He could write out a check for several million dollars easily for the Hilltop Youth and solve our problems. Will he do it? I doubt it. Thank you, Nachas. And now we go to our friend Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, I enjoyed your interview with Alex Newman. I never heard of him. What station or network is he on? He's on the Lindell TV station. They're on TV. And they also, you know, he's also, of course, on the internet. It's called Lindell TV. You know who Lindell is? Mike Lindell of the pillow guy, My Pillow. Used to do all the MyPillow commercials on Fox News before he became politically incorrect. Now they won't let him do his commercials there. So he finally got it. He decided to get his... Just like he said, he couldn't sleep at night, so he decided to make a pillow that was comfortable enough. He also couldn't do his commercials on Fox News, so he decided to get his own channel on his own network on television. He's an evangelical Christian. I don't know much about him except that he is a fanatic Trumpster. Other than that, I don't know very much about him. But his Alex Newman was willing to give me the right to speak on his show, and I'm hoping that we'll be back on his show. So, you know, I'm grateful for that. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And we go now to our very good friend Chabad Kahanist, who writes, and I quote, Do Schwarzes have an identity crisis? I ask this because when I was younger, they were called colored, then Negro, then Black, then Afro-American, then Black again, now African-American. What's up with this? Unquote. Yeah, well, of course they do. Of course they do, because they don't want... What is their true identity? They came out of the jungles of Africa. They had no written language, never accomplished anything in history, nothing. They were taken first by the Arabs as slaves, and then they imitated the Arabs, and that's why many of them are Muslims, even though the Arabs were very brutal to them. The real slave trade was Muslim slave trade. The Muslims are the ones that did slave trade, and to this day, the Muslims have very large numbers of black slaves all over the Muslim world. And yet they identify with Muslims. So, you know, they have no history of their own, they're ashamed of their own history, their real history, so they try to steal other people's history. That's why they say they're black Hebrews, that they're the real Jews. You know, come on. So of course they use everything under the sun to try to enhance their self-esteem. They want to enhance their self-esteem because they have none. And no matter how much Hollywood and television and the media and the internet glorify them and demand that we worship black people, we literally worship them now. No matter how much that's done, they know, deep down they know, that something's very wrong. Over 80% of their children are illegitimate. Their fathers abandon them when they're babies. They know there's something very bad there. With all the advantages they've been given, look what a disaster they are. They know. They know. So they try to enhance their self-esteem with different names, all types of mythology about their history. You know, they try to do their best, but it doesn't work. Thank you, Chabad Kahanist. And now we go to Kahana Was Right BT, another very good friend of ours, longtime JTFer, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, will the leaking of the Roe v. Wade decision help the Democrats avoid a slaughtering in the midterm elections? I think it certainly does help the Democrats, but I'm not sure or was intended to help the Democrats, but I'm not sure they're going to be able to avoid getting slaughtered in the midterm elections. I think the Democrats are going to have a very, very bad outcome this November. I think they're going to get hurt badly. I think the Republicans are going to retake both houses of Congress. And I think it's going to be a very dramatic victory for the Republicans this November. Despite leaking decisions or trying to get the left and the Democrat base riled up, because the Democrat base is apathetic and discouraged because they see that Joe Biden is such a failure. So they're not even motivated to come out and vote. That's the problem. So they're hoping that things like this, boy, your right to murder your babies is going to be threatened. Now, you won't be able to commit murder. That's what they're worried about. So, you know, they're trying to rile up the base and to make sure they get out and vote. I still think the Republican turnout will be much better than the Democrat turnout. Connor Was Right now writes, and I quote, do you believe this leaked decision will approximate the final decision of the Roe v. Wade case with majority vote, or do you think one or more justices will switch sides and the whole thing will have been a deception, unquote? I don't know. That's a good question. That's a very good question, because people are assuming that because this was leaked, that means the Supreme Court is going to vote the way supposedly this leak indicates. And I'm not sure about that at all. I share I see your skepticism in the question, and I share your skepticism. I'm not sure at all. I really don't know. We'll find out. I know that the justices on the Supreme Court, in my opinion, almost all of them are complete phonies. And look at them with the gay marriage, with the other crazy things they've made decisions on. You know, they're phonies, they're frauds, they're part of the establishment, so they are subject to pressure, and who knows? Who knows what will happen. Thank you, Kahana Was Right, and now we go to our friend Harel156, who writes, and I quote, Der Chaim, what is the reason self-hating Jews, members of the disgusting Shalom Achshav, want to destroy Chomish? Can you explain the behavior? Are these Jews naive or evil or both? Unquote. They're evil. They're evil, Harel. And they're filled with hatred. These are Jews. The worst Gentile anti-Semites don't hate Jews as much as they do. These are the worst anti-Semites. Chomish, by the way, is a hilltop community, a beautiful hilltop community. It was destroyed as part of one of the 40 communities that was destroyed when Arik Sharon, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro Shem Rishayim Yirkav, expelled the Jews in Gush Katif, and then four Jewish, beautiful Jewish communities in northern Samaria were also destroyed. One of them was Chomish. And so this is a community, which they've tried to rebuild, and they've tried to resettle it, and they keep attacking and destroying it, and the Shalom Achshav and left-wing Jews announced, we're going to go in and do it ourselves. The government isn't doing it well enough. We're going to go in and do it ourselves, even though the government is repeatedly destroying their structures there. By the way, JTF, I can tell you that the equipment they have in Chomish and the for their preparedness for when attacks do come on them by the Israeli army and the police come to destroy their homes and so on, their ability, because they're blocked off, and so it's hard for them to have equipment and get through. Equipment has gotten through to them, and JTF is the one that paid for that equipment, so, and paid for their supplies and everything, and they have supplies, and they have the ability to stay there a long time with the supplies and all types of equipment, even if they're going to be blocked off because of JTF. There was a very big delivery of equipment to them recently, and JTF paid for it. Thank you, Harel, and I want to thank everybody else for another program that I very much enjoy doing of Ask JTF, and let's hope, Bezrat Hashem, that together we can make a big difference here. I know JTF is really making a difference now with the Hilltop Youth, but we need to make a much bigger difference. We need much more help. We're doing a lot. We're doing whatever we can, but we need to do much more. And that means everybody watching should think of what can they do to help us, to advance the cause, to spread the word, to make contributions yourselves as well. Do all the things that are needed. We need your help, and the Jewish people and Israel need your help. And the time is now. For JTF, until next week, this is Chaim Ben Pesach. Shalom.